Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Victor Cha here at CSIS in the office of the Korea Chair, and we're very happy this afternoon to invite you, have you here for the Korea platform. Today's platform is a conversation with someone I think many of you are familiar with from his writings throughout the years, Donald Kirk. Donald was the sole correspondent for the International Herald Tribune from 1997 to 2003, also filing for the New York Times and CBS covering the nuclear and economic crises. In addition, Mr. Kirk has written articles for magazines as diverse as The Institutional Investor, The New Leader, National Review, The Nation, Soldier of Fortune, Kyoto Journal, Hemispheres, and commentaries for The Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, and South China Morning Post. He is currently the Korea correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Donald Kirk first visited Seoul in 1972 as the Far East correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, and has covered major events in Korea from the assassination of Park Jung-hee in 1979, the Gwangju Revolt in 1980, to every presidential election since the adoption of the Democratic Constitution in 1987. From 1988 to 1994, he focused on economics and labor, writing Korean Dynasty, Hyundai, and Chungju-young, a book that I used in my course in Korean foreign policy at Georgetown, which was a critical study of Hyundai, Korea's largest chaebol, and its founder, Chungju-young. And again, in 2000, he wrote Korean Crisis, Unraveling of the Miracle in the IMF Era. We're here today to discuss his newest book, titled Korea Betrayed, Kim Dae-jung and Sunshine, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan just a couple of months ago. Don continues to file for CBS News Radio, and the University of Maryland University College in 2004 awarded him an honorary degree as, quote, one of the United States' most knowledgeable observers and commentators on Asia, unquote. It's a particular pleasure for me to have to host Don here today. I've been a big fan of his work over the years, and many of us who've done research and writing on Korea have benefited from the many articles and analyses that he's written over the years about Korean domestic politics and about foreign policy. So, Don, it's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't I just stand while talking and take
it
down?
Okay, all right.
There we go. Well, thanks very much for that kind introduction. I'm reminded that you know, I did first visit Korea in 1972, and looking out over the audience here, I see another veteran of that trip, Don Oberdorfer. We both covered the Red Cross talks between North and South Korea. That was my first experience. I don't know about Don's, but that was my first experience in Korea. Don wrote a very colorful account of a wonderful reception that was given there. And I'm not sure I was invited to that reception, but at least I wasn't there. And but I was at a lot of other events there. And one of the most striking events, one of the stops on a correspondence tour, let's say, was Kim Dae-jung's home in Mapo-gu, Seoul. To find Kim Dae-jung, all you had to do was to tell a taxi driver outside the chosen hotel that I would like to see Kim Dae-jung, and he would take you there. They all knew where he lived. And you had to ring the door, and someone whom I saw many times again over the years would come to the door and tell you just wait a few minutes and he'd be available. So I had a great interview with him then. We all wanted that story. We all wanted that human rights story. And, you know, we were all interested in what the KCIA was up to. There were KCIA people out in the alley beside his home. And, you know, human rights and the suppression of rights during the Park Chung-hee era was a major story, and one of the stories that correspondents always pursued. The next time I saw Kim Dae-jung was in, I think it's 1973 or so. He had a much better story to tell. He returned from Japan. He'd been kidnapped in Japan. During a trip to Japan, he'd been kidnapped at the behest of Park Chung-hee, and he had a very dramatic story to tell. And what I remember about his telling that story was he told the story many times, but he told it to me as if he were telling it the first time. You know, every moment, every little incident in the story, he said with great excitement and intensity. And, you know, you never had the feeling that, oh, he was just running through a story that he'd already told a dozen or two dozen other correspondents. It was as if you were getting your own exclusive story. Certainly, he had this great political appeal. And for a number of years, that was the kind of story that we covered. I came back again. I was off and on in and out of Korea during the 1970s, and then I joined USA Today about 1982. Kim Dae-jung went to the States. I should point out, before he went to the States, he was tried in 1980 for his role in the Gwangju Revolt. And, of course, I covered the Gwangju Revolt. I was in Gwangju, and I was on the streets of Seoul. I didn't attend his trial, but there are a number of pool reports on his trial which make a very good account of the trial and which form a chapter in this book, as a matter of fact. So there is a very good sort of running account of Kim Dae-jung's trial. He was sentenced to death. Of course, this was vacated. This was changed into a life sentence or a sentence of 20 years after a great deal of pressure from the American embassy. And he eventually, after serving time in prison, was more or less exiled to the U.S., exiled to Harvard, where he had a fellowship and was living in the D.C. area. So he was splitting his time between Harvard and Washington, and I think focusing more on politics than on Harvard. Although while at Harvard, he formed he wrote a great sort of idealistic economic tract, which attacked the government and attacked the government's economic policies, not very realistically, but nevertheless, it was sort of one of his important works. So while he was at Harvard, while he was living, while he had an office in Springfield, Virginia, I was with USA Today one day. One of his aides called me and told me that DJ would like to see me, so I saw him in a cafeteria near the USA Today building, and DJ told me that he planned again to return to Korea. So over, you know, he put some beef stroganoff on his plate, as I recall, and I forget what I got, but we talked about this, and I took notes excitedly and went back to USA Today and told them I had this exclusive story that Kim Dae-jung was going back to Korea. They weren't at all interested. I think I wrote several paragraphs. I'm not sure it even had my byline on it. I haven't been able to find the story in any files. About 2 weeks later, Don did the exclusive story on Kim Dae-jung returning to Korea. So thank you, Don, for that story. But anyway, I did interview Kim Dae-jung before he returned to Korea. Did have an interview that did get into USA Today. But it was kind of an interesting, odd moment in my journalistic career that I should have had this fun conversation with DJ in a cafeteria, standing in line in a cafeteria near, in Roslyn, while he was talking about his great plan to return and return to politics and make a bid for power. And Don knows the story. You had the complete story in the Washington Post, and thank you very much. But I think it's in your book, too. But anyway, Kim Dae-jung's career after that was one of political proselytizing and so forth, in which gradually he sort of changed from being the far leftist figure that he'd appeared, adopted a more centrist policy. I'm not saying a completely centrist policy, but let's say about 1986 or so, I was in Korea for the Asia Games for USA Today. They did want that covered. I was in there for the Asia Games and also for the 1988 Olympics. In 86, I interviewed DJ and asked him what he thought of the Chaebol and what he thought of these terrible economic groups that were dominating the economy and repressing labor and so forth. And I thought he'd love to talk about this because he'd written about this kind of thing before. But he said no. In fact, he didn't want to talk about the Chaebol. He didn't want to talk about, he wasn't going to criticize the big business combine, some of which, of course, were donating money to him, hedging bets and so forth. So he moved to a centrist position. But the great evolution in his policy, well, in 1987, of course, No Tae-woo won the presidency. Kim Dae-jung and Kim Il-sung could not settle on a single candidacy. All the naive foreign correspondents thought surely that they would do that, but they didn't. There was no way that they would. I should go back, perhaps, at this point to the regional differences that made so much, that have so much to do with Korean politics. In his career, and none of us, very few of us journalists really understood this at the time, But in his career, throughout his career, he was supported by 90, 95% of the votes from the southwestern Korean region, the Chola region, north and south Chola provinces, and the city of Gwangju. And so with this kind of support, this was the support that formed his power base, whereas Kim Il-sung was from the southeastern portion of Korea, from near Pusan. If not from Pusan, I can't remember exactly if Pusan was his native city. I think it was, actually. Kim Il-sung was from southeastern Korea, from this Pusan, this Korea's second largest city. And there was no way that these two divergent political figures could unite behind a single candidate. There was no way that Kim Dae-jung was going to support Kim Il-sung or vice versa in a presidential campaign, which for foreigners was very hard to understand. In a Korean context, of course, it makes perfect sense. But anyway, Kim Il-sung and Kim Dae-jung both lost that first election under Korea's new democracy constitution in December of 1987. They both charged massive fraud. They both declared the election was null and void and so forth. But they really had themselves to blame. No Tae-woo was easily going to win if they split their ticket. The 1988 Olympics sort of was a period of, let's say, a truce in which nobody wanted to be guilty of undermining the Olympics. Nobody wanted to be the bad guy and spoiling the party and so forth. But after the 1988 Olympics, Kim Dae-jung did go to study in Cambridge. He came back in 1992, ran again for president. This time he lost to Kim Il-sung by a considerable margin, despite the fact that Kim Il-sung lost votes to Chung Ju-young, the figure behind the Hyundai Empire, the founder of the Hyundai Empire, who thought that everybody's economic policies were terrible and thought that he had the answer to Korea's problems. Chung Ju-young actually, I was writing my book about Chung Ju-young at the time, he actually thought he had a serious chance of winning the election. He got about, I think, 19% of the votes, which was not a small number. He had no chance of winning the election, but he waged a very intense and very well-financed campaign, took votes away from Kim Il-sung, but not enough to propel Kim Dae-jung into the presidency. Kim Dae-jung conceded that election. He didn't charge Kim Il-sung with cheating and so forth. One irony of all this, though, was that Kim Il-sung formed an alliance with No Tae-woo, a political alliance with No Tae-woo, extremely opportunistic alliance. So that was one factor that helped Kim Il-sung win the presidency. In the 1997 political campaign, the ultimate irony was that Kim Dae-jung formed an alliance with Kim Jong-pil, who had been one of the founders, if not the founder, of the Korea Central Intelligence Agency, which had been Kim Dae-jung's archenemy many years earlier. So we have all these political, opportunistic political goings-on there. But the real basis for the there were several factors that came together that made Kim Dae-jung the winner in the 1997 election. One was the fact that a political conservative former governor of Gyeonggi province surrounding Seoul waged his own third-party campaign, taking many votes from Lee Wae-chang, the conservative candidate. Another was that Korea at that time was in the midst of an economic crisis in which the IMF had to bail Korea out, more or less. Certainly people were thinking that a change in leadership might be a good idea. Kim Il-sung was an ineffective economic leader. Korea needed a change in leadership. So we had these various factors coming together. Kim Dae-jung won by a narrow margin of 1.6% of the votes. So we have this very odd phenomenon of the rise of Kim Dae-jung. But what made his presidency much more interesting was his dedication to the Sunshine Policy of reconciliation with North Korea. And it was that dedication to the Sunshine Policy, I think, that cast doubts on his legacy and cast doubts on his success as a political leader. Kim Dae-jung was willing to compromise with North Korea at just about all costs in order to get a summit with Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader. There were reports, constant reports, of payoffs in North Korea. I wrote a story for the International Herald Tribune, which I think ran in early 2001, after the summit, in which I said that maybe the sum of $500 million had been transferred to North Korea. This story, of course, evoked a terrific denial from the government, which wrote a lengthy letter to the IHT. The IHT at that time was edited by David Ignatius, who called me and asked me about my sources and so forth, and I sort of waffled and said I, didn't really have a lot of really great sources, but that's what I understood had happened. And David printed the letter and so forth, but didn't run any apology and didn't run any retraction and so forth. In other words, I thought he took a fairly gutsy position, frankly. In effect, he stood up for me in a rather in a very controversial story without saying that he was standing up for me. It was just clear that he wasn't doing taking any action except to run the letter. So I always admired, I don't know David very well. He's here in Washington. I don't see him and so forth. He's not someone I deal with. I see his column, but nonetheless, I've always admired him then and in retrospect for, in effect, not letting me down, as a lot of other editors might have done and certainly would have done under similar circumstances. But the question was, what proof was there of this payoff to North Korea? That all came out in hearings in the National Assembly. After, I think it was during the presidency of Kim Dae-jung's successor, No Mu-hyun, in which indeed the payoffs were verified, in which indeed there was evidence of the payoffs, and in which a number of people were accused, including Kim Dae-jung's closest aides, including the architect of the summit, a very astute political figure named Im Dong-won, including Kim Dae-jung's right-hand man, Park Ji-won. Both of them were accused, and both of them were charged, and both of them went to trial and so forth. But the real tragedy of that whole episode was that Chung Mong-hun, who was the fifth son of Chung Ju-young, and was the head of the core Hyundai group and head of the company Hyundai Asan, which was responsible for Korea's dealings with North Korea, had projects in North Korea, the tourism project, Mount Kumgang, tourism zone and the Kaesong economic zone and so forth, committed suicide in August of 2003 rather than face up to the charges against him. I was there at the time. I went to his funeral. I was the only foreigner at his funeral. I talked to his brothers and so forth, all of them titans of business, loyally standing by their brother and so forth. But Chung Mong-hun's suicide sort of underlined the basic corruption that was going on. North Korea immediately came out with statements saying that it was a murder, an assassination. It's unlikely that it was an assassination. Nothing could be ruled out, but it's unlikely. He jumped from the 14th floor of the Hyundai headquarters early one morning. I got calls from a couple of newspapers. Got a call from the New York Times, actually. And Jim Brook... I hate to say this, he took my information and used it in his story, which was rather shocking to me. Everybody was very much aghast at what had happened here in Korea, what had happened over in Korea as a result of this investigation, which underlined the fact that there had been a lot going on. There had been money passing back and forth and so forth, and that there had been massive payoffs to North Korea. Now, over the years since then, I've asked Kim Dae-jung about this a couple of times. He always said that those payoffs were part of a commission to finance Hyundai Asan's ventures in North Korea. Hyundai Asan did have to pay money in order to invest in Korea, but the money that we're talking about was not for that purpose. The money went through Hyundai Asan, went via the Hyundai Asan company into accounts overseas in Macau, Singapore, and elsewhere, in Hong Kong maybe. But Macau anyway, and I think Singapore, to the tune of at least $500 million. It could have been much more. You'll get sensationalists in Korea that say, "Oh, it was as much as $8 billion." Some people say, "I'm pretty sure it was $2 billion." We don't exactly know how much. But I think what is most disconcerting about this episode was that that's what it took to get the summit going. And also that money, of course, helped to finance North Korea's nuclear program, its military program, and so forth. Kim Dae-jung, throughout his career, would always attack South Korea's leaders, many of whom were certainly vulnerable to attack and certainly not very decent people, certainly had terrible policies and so forth. He hated Syngman Rhee, or Lee Syngman. He hated Park Chung-hee. He hated Chun Doo-hwan. He also would attack No Tae-woo, and he would attack... just about anybody who stood in his way. But he never attacked Kim Jong-il. He never talked about Kim Jong-il's human rights abuses, and he certainly didn't attack North Korea for its nuclear program, nor did he cite the danger of North Korea's 1.1 million troops and all those artillery pieces right above the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas. It's a really a grave irony about his career that he would not attack Kim Jong-il for the sake of, as he always explained, for the sake of reconciliation with North Korea, while attacking all the leaders who had stood against him throughout in the early years of his career. It's hard to know what to make of this legacy. Was his opportunism justified? Can you rationalize it? Maybe you can. Maybe it doesn't matter if North Korea has a nuclear program. Maybe so what? So are they going to have a nuclear? So they have nuclear weapons. Are they going to fire them at anybody? People ask these questions. I think it does matter, and I think that it does pose a danger. Yet another point that I make in this book is his pursuit of the Nobel Prize. I'm not sure who put it into his mind that the Nobel Peace Prize was a really tremendous thing to have. But over the years, from the 1980s onward, he wanted nothing more than to win the Nobel Prize, whether that would help to make him president or having become president help to ensure his place in history, I'm not sure. But there are many reports, some of which I cite in the book, of all the manipulation and maneuvering that went on to bring about the Nobel Peace Prize. I finally got back to the Nobel people because one of the people who read this book, a very good journalist named Hal Piper, who was editor of Joongang Daily and formerly that's the English language offshoot of Joongang Ilbo, and formerly a Baltimore Sun correspondent, read the manuscript and he said, "Well, Don, what do the Nobel people say about this?" And I said, "Well, I didn't think that they were going to say very much," but I got back to them and I got their no comments. I got the Bishop of Norway saying that he never talks about the awarding of Nobel Prizes and things like that, all of which made one paragraph in the book. This is your basic, they denied the charge type paragraph. The lawyer says on behalf of his client, he denied the charge or he's not guilty or whatever. But I did put that in the book at the behest of Hal Piper, who said I really had to have it there. But why did DJ want the Nobel Prize so badly? What was the reason? What was so important to him about the Nobel Prize? I'm not quite sure. Certainly, his pursuit of the Nobel Prize paralleled his pursuit of sunshine policy with North Korea. It also paralleled his pursuit of the presidency. So we have this very controversial figure in Korean history. One special added footnote to the controversy surrounding him is that all his sons eventually were caught up in corruption of one sort or another. Now, those of you who've been to Korea know that every day you can pick up a paper and see stories about corruption of people in high places, wives taking gifts, sons getting involved in conflict of interest, money passing from the table to some government officials going on trial, getting fired. These stories are routine. What happened to Kim Dae-jung's sons would not have been noticed except for the fact that he was president. Two of his sons went to jail. The third son, the oldest son, suffers from a very debilitating case of, I'm not quite sure what it is, but Parkinson's disease, whatever it is, he can hardly function, and they didn't put him in jail. They just, gave him probation and so forth. Eventually, incidentally, these people generally, under some future president, get pardoned or somehow get let off. I think that Kim Dae-jung's, his middle son, eventually got a full pardon and ran for the National Assembly, was able to run for the National Assembly. Didn't make it to the National Assembly, but lost the election. In the same election, Park Ji-won, Kim Dae-jung's close aide, who did go to jail for some time, got a pardon, got off, ran for the National Assembly, won, and is a member of the National Assembly now. So he feels vindicated and exonerated. That's how politics works in Korea. So I simply mention all this record so that to give an idea of the mixed record that the mixed legacy that DJ leaves behind. I should point out, in the process of writing this book, which I was vastly delayed by having to write newspaper articles and so forth, I was on the index. I insisted on doing my own index because which many people don't do, because I want to make sure that everything I want in the index gets in the index. And also, in the process of doing an index, those of you who've written books will know that you will always find little errors as you go through, as you do your own index. So I was doing my index when DJ passed away, and so I having spent years sort of off and on doing this project, suddenly like a reporter on Deadline, I had to put a new lead on the book and a new closing on the book and so forth. You're not supposed at that stage while doing your index to be updating and revising and writing. You're supposed to be just doing the index. All the revisions are done. Nevertheless, I managed to get a first paragraph and a closing paragraph of the book. in which I tried to sort of lighten up in my criticism. I mean, the man had passed away. There was tremendous mourning. And if I could just take a look and see, there was one sentence in there which may show how I was trying to take a somewhat softer, gentler view. And it's a short sentence, and so let me just see what I wrote here. Let me see. From a firmament, this was after DJ's funeral, North Korean delegates came down to attend the funeral. They saw President Im Yong-bak and so forth. And, they lightened up on their rhetoric against Im Yong-bak. They no longer called him a traitor, an American lackey. So my sentence in this hastily written final page, from a firmament in the for the world's apostles of peace, Kim Dae-jung had to be smiling. That's not quite the end of the book, but it's the end of the end of the penultimate paragraph of the book. So, I don't know. I would have hoped that Kim Dae-jung would have lived long enough to have seen this book. I was very saddened by his passing and so forth. I was here in Washington at the time, didn't go to his funeral, but nonetheless, did what I could to sort of round off the book with that event. Other sad events occurred in the final period of the book. Michael Jackson died. This might seem irrelevant, except for the fact that Michael Jackson had attended Kim Dae-jung's inauguration in 1997, wearing a great red hat. I was there, fur coat. George Soros was also there. And two presidents who'd gone to jail, Chun Doo-hwan and No Tae-woo, who were both going to jail for the Gwangju Revolt, were also at Kim Dae-jung's inauguration. Michael Jackson came back in 1999 and did a whole concert for peace or for Children of the World or something of that sort. He passed away 10 years to the day after that concert. And Kim Dae-jung, not yet in the hospital, praised Michael Jackson as a man of peace or whatever. So I got that in the book, too. And also the other person who passed away, perhaps more relevant, is Nomu Hyun. He committed suicide. Kim Dae-jung was at Nomu Hyun's funeral. Very saddening event for him. It was after his funeral that Kim Dae-jung came down with his final illness of pneumonia, from which he never recovered. That's basically it. I should point out one other passage of one other person who died, Mary Travers. I'm leaving on a jet plane. She sang at one of Kim Dae-jung's farewell parties, which I attended before he returned to Korea in 1985 or so. I saw her singing, standing 20 feet away from me. Singing I'm Leaving on a Jet Plane. She passed away recently, too, after the book came out. But anyway, all this very saddening, most of all Kim Dae-jung's demise. So that's, basically a sort of a summary of what I've written and where I'm coming from and so forth. I found that over the years, I was terribly disillusioned by what he stood for and where he was going in Korean history and in Northeast Asian history. Other people will disagree. One point I make in this book is that he was kind of the darling of American liberals and American intellectuals and so forth. I'm sure that many of them will not take kindly to criticism of their hero figure, but nonetheless, this is what I've laid out here. There will be writers who will write much more extensively about Kim Dae-jung. I look forward to seeing what they say. There's much more research to be done, but this is maybe a beginning. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Don. That was a wonderful summary of the book. I'm sure people have some questions. Let me start with one, and that is that, as you mentioned, there was a lot of death that surrounded this book, but there was a lot of death that surrounded the past couple of years in Korean politics, and with the passing of Kim Dae-jung.
Well, I think that, first of all, one should never predict the future about Korea because Korean history has been so full of surprises, one of which was the rise of Kim Dae-jung to the presidency, which one would not have predicted when I first went to Korea in 1972 or even 10 or 20 years later. But But I think it's an essentially conservative society. On the other hand, I don't think it can quite revert to the repression that characterized earlier eras. I don't think that's going to happen unless there's a second Korean War, which I also don't quite think is going to happen. I think there's always, in the foreseeable future, I think there are going to be negotiations, compromise, vacillation, all kinds of things, but I don't think there'll be a second Korean War. But, the future of, of course, beyond a second Korean War is the concern about a regional war. I can't quite see these things happening. I hope these are not famous last words, because we've been so often surprised by events in Korean history that somehow I think that Korea will manage, in short, in response to your question, to pursue an almost moderate centrist line despite great exceptions, despite numerous protests, despite leftist radicalism, despite conservative, conservatism and conservative repression, attempts at conservative repression.
And PJ was, as you said, he was, a big part of his place in Korean politics had to do with regionalism and the support he got from the region. Some people look at him as, someone who was victimized by regionalism, particularly during the Park Geun-hye years, but others look at him and say he was actually one of the people that fomented regionalism because he relied so much on his core base in the Cholla provinces. Where do you think the future of regionalism is in Korean politics with people like DJ and Kim Jong-pil and Kim Il-sung no longer?
Well, you've raised a very good point. I mean, maybe he did. Certainly he's been accused of fomenting regionalism. Park Chung-hee campaigned in South Cholla province, I think, in 1963 or sometime like that, and actually got a big audience. He wouldn't have dared go back there again, I don't think, later years. Kim Il-sung made a speech in Gwangju, I think it was, got booed off the platform. I forget what the year was. Maybe in the 1987 presidential election campaign. Or was it 92? I'm not sure. But I mentioned that in my book, incidentally. So somewhere I have been known to know the year, and I could look it up in my book again. But anyway, I think that regionalism is a underlying factor that you cannot escape in Korea. Now, it's very easy to gloss this over, and it's very easy to think that maybe they've outgrown regionalism, especially sophisticated people in Seoul. But I have to say, when you're in Seoul chatting with people and you get a staunch defense of Kim Dae-jung, and the guy says, he's really one of our great heroes, you ask where the guy's from, and I'm sorry to say, but about 99 times out of 100, he'll be from South Cholla or North Cholla province or Gwangju. That's the way it is. If you find these people who criticize Kim Dae-jung severely, most severely, they will not be from that region. They will be from anywhere but that region. So I don't think you can escape regionalism in Korea. How significant it is, where it's going, I don't know. I was about to say that just about any Korean would know, but in fact, Koreans don't really evaluate that always so honestly either. So it's a very difficult and sensitive topic. I talk about, obviously, Chung Mong-hun. I don't talk about the relationship with Chung Ju-young. And there's an awful lot of stuff that I don't cover and don't know. And maybe you're telling me something, that there was this intense relationship. who knows? I do know that Chung Ju-young, when he ran for president in 1992, did not criticize Kim Dae-jung as he did Kim Il-sung. He would give these speeches calling Kim Il-sung a stonehead idiot in front of these great crowds and so forth. He loved to call him, names. He never called Kim Dae-jung names, if that is indicative of anything. I always thought it was because he regarded Kim Il-sung as his main foe in the campaign and didn't take Kim Dae-jung that seriously. But he also could have, had his own arrangements. There's all kinds of arrangements that go on that nobody really knows, and certainly not a foreign journalist anyway. No, I didn't. I was here. Yeah, I was at Park Chung-hee's funeral, incidentally. And by the way, I read reports here. You know, that was a period when Park Chung-hee was reviled by American liberals, of course, also by not an inconsiderable number of American diplomats. I think Richard Holbrooke made a remark that there wasn't a tear shed in the whole funeral ceremony. Dead wrong. 2 million people lined the avenue. Lots of tears shed. He was the father figure. He'd raised Korea, he'd elevated the economy. There were plenty of tears shed for Park Chung-hee. I've talked to people in Seoul who say that they regard Park Chung-hee and Kim Dae-jung as Korea's two greatest presidents. So, you know, figure that out.
And do you go much into his the role that DJ played in the economic crisis?
Yeah, I do to a certain extent. Kim Dae-jung in the economic crisis was pretty good about getting good people to mastermind the crisis. During the campaign, of course, he accused the government of selling out to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, of betraying Korea and all that. As soon as he got elected president, he changed his tune. And, he recognized the need to get really quite tough with some of the excesses of the Chaebol, which, you know, should not have been that surprising, considering that he'd been one of the Chaebol's arch critics in his really radical days. But nevertheless, during the campaign, he wasn't criticizing the Chaebol; he was criticizing the government for selling out to the IMF. After that, he got on to the idea that the IMF really had a significant role to play and that the Chaebol had to be reined in. And he appointed some pretty good people to deal with the Chaebol, one of whom I saw a number of times, Lee Hoon Jae, head of the Financial Supervisory Commission, was that what it was? I'm pretty sure it was. Sometimes I get the terminology confused. But some of these people got very tough, and they formed organizations to deal with Chaebol debt and to eliminate a number of the zombie groups and so forth. Not entirely. Not everything changed, but nonetheless, Kim Dae-jung's role, Kim Dae-jung as president, let some of his people do the job that had to be done before moving on to what he cared most about, which was his policy of reconciliation with North Korea.
When you look at the Sunshine Policy, clearly very different view of it as it was unfolding than when you look back on it. And with more and more revelations about North Korea and the second nuclear program and all this, Sunshine Policy is even more critically analyzed. But overall, do you think, what was it about the Sunshine Policy that you say, for example, DJ was the darling of American liberals in the U.S.? What was it about the Sunshine Policy in the end that was so appealing to a large portion of internationalists, in the sense that he won the Nobel Prize, but also to a large portion of Koreans? What do you think made it so appealing to them?
Well, I think that there had been a sense that these militarist regimes, so to speak, in the South, which were regarded as militarist by many critics, they were former generals, Park Chung-hee and Chun Doo-hwan, and No Tae-woo, all former generals. I think there was a sense that all you had to do was sort of be nice to North Korea, and perhaps North Korea would lighten up. If we just talk nice and show a willingness to reconcile, then we can all get along. Certainly, that was Kim Dae-jung's view. And I think a lot of people took that view. There was an awful lot of criticism, I'm sure you will recall, of President Bush's seemingly hard line toward North Korea in the first two or three years of his presidency. Kim Dae-jung never got over President Bush's position. He, as we all know, President Bush, I think it was in 2002, lumped North Korea into an axis of evil that included Iraq and Iran. I think it was a State of the Union address in January of 2002. Kim Dae-jung saw President Bush not long after that, as I recall, in Korea. And, they all got along well. They went up to Dora Station, the last station on the line to North Korea, newly built, dedicated a plaque and made polite remarks and so forth. But when I saw Kim Dae-jung after he was, sometime after he stepped down, I didn't have an interview, but I sat in on an interview, which the CBS TV correspondent had. I was told I would represent CBS Radio, but was told not to ask any questions. But Anyway, this TV correspondent came in and got all these nice comments from Kim Dae-jung, in which he said that, you know, in which he excoriated George W. Bush, that for 6 years we got nowhere because of Bush. I attended speeches that Kim Dae-jung gave at Harvard and at Fletcher School in, I think it was the spring of 2008, not long ago, in which he again excoriated President Bush, made President Bush sort of the bad guy, which is very interesting to me, because I didn't think that blame actually was justified. I don't think that President Clinton would have gotten any further had he remained president. I don't think that had Kerry become president or Gore become president, that there would have been any significant difference in North Korea's nuclear program or its missile program. So but nevertheless, I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but nevertheless, you know, there was, Bush was sort of made to be the bad guy by Kim Dae-jung. You know, the U.S. was blamed by Kim Dae-jung for the failure of the Sunshine Policy. Whereas the real feeling was that, as far as Kim Dae-jung was concerned, if he could just have pursued this policy further, if he could just have, if the U.S. had just taken a softer line and had just been more open to compromise and reconciliation, then the policy would have worked. I don't think that's true, frankly.
Do you think that the Sunshine Policy, it was a policy of reconciliation, but do you think that the Sunshine Policy had a denuclearization component to it, or was it a priority of reconciliation over denuclearization?
Hmm.
One of the challenges, for example, during the Bush administration, one of the challenges we had with the Nomi Hun government,
yeah,
was that they had an inter-Korean policy that was focused on inter-Korean reconciliation. And denuclearization was important, but that was not part of the inter-reconciliation agenda per se. The big difference under Lee Myung-bak is he has very clearly linked denuclearization with inter-Korean relations. So I guess the question is, for, you know, during the Sunshine Policy, you know, in all of, you know, you're talking to Kim Dae-jung in your study of him, I mean, how did he feel about this particular problem, nuclear weapons in North Korea?
Well, he would always sort of ritualistically say that North Korea had to get rid of its nukes. He didn't use the term nuke, but he would ritualistically say that had to happen. But I do think that there was a higher priority, as your question implies, on reconciliation, whereas there certainly has been a change in President Lee's view that North Korea first has to get rid of its nuclear weapons. And it's, you know, whatever it takes to fire nuclear weapons, it's missiles and so forth. So there's certainly been a difference in emphasis, and I do think that the priority for Kim Dae-jung was not North Korea getting rid of its nukes. The priority was reconciliation, which was carried out, which was evident in all the trips to North Korea by so many figures of all sorts, academics, religious, athletic figures, students, and so forth. All kinds of trips to North Korea. People could go to just sign up with a travel agency to go to the Arirang Festival on an overnight trip. So the emphasis in under DJ was reconciliation. I'm not sure that he really took North Korea's nuclear program that seriously. Certainly in 2002, when James Kelly went to Pyongyang and, you know, got the impression, which North Korea denied, but then earlier last year reaffirmed, got the impression that there was a highly enriched uranium program going on, and told this to the North Koreans, and they allegedly, North Korea's negotiator, Vice Minister Kang, according to the translator who was there, reaffirmed that yes, yes we do, or yes, you're right, or something like that. Not quite clear what was said, but nonetheless, I'm not sure that Kim Dae-jung took that uranium program seriously at all. I know that some Americans in high positions didn't take it seriously. I think Robert Gallucci was saying, oh, you know, it's not that big a deal, it's not important and so forth, it's not part of our 1994 Geneva Framework Agreement and all that. I saw him saying that. So I think that there was really very much of a difference in emphasis. That DJ's whole approach, his whole thrust was reconciliation, and I was tempted to say reconciliation at any cost, but I didn't quite say that.
Well, you know, I just on the uranium enrichment, I think I could be wrong, but the way I remember Gallucci describing it was that when those revelations first came out, of course, he wasn't in the government anymore. But what he did say was that the agreed framework had a clause that said all parties would respect the inter-Korean joint denuclearization declaration between the North and the South, which had as a component of it the banning of any sort of uranium enrichment activity. So without passing judgment on whether the North admitted or not, he said that any such action, if true, would be a violation of 94.
Was uranium actually in there? Was the word uranium in there?
In the...
What you're signing?
Joint Denuclearization Declaration?
Yeah.
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I believe it was. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I asked him the same question. I asked him...
You heard it from him directly.
I asked him the same question. He said, you know, we linked the two, so...
Yeah, but...
I don't know what he said publicly. I don't know.
To say that we linked the two, you know, he wasn't very emphatic about that. He really thought that much too much is being made of highly enriched uranium.
Yeah.
I mean, he really... There was a whole difference in Gallucci's emphasis from the emphasis of later people.
Sure. And I noticed, as I was looking at your book as you were speaking, I noticed that you do have some interviews there in which you interviewed people who were there for that conversation in 2002.
Oh, right.
Said the North Koreans admitted to having uranium at that time when Kelly confronted them.
Well, right, the translator, to be specific, so, you know. But we don't have to worry about that conversation so much because North Korea, 1 year ago, in January of last year, I believe, said they had an enriched uranium program. Some people think it's gone quite fairly far. It's not just a few, tubes or whatever they are, you know, it's just... You know, it could be a few thousand, who knows, from Pakistan and AQ Khan Network and that kind of thing. There's a lot more research that has to be done on this. And, of course, we all hope it's all highly abstract. There's some view that it's all nonsense anyway. Don't worry about their nukes and don't worry about their highly enriched uranium. Get on with reconciliation. That was DJ's view, in my opinion.
So, expanding this more broadly beyond the book, where do you, on the whole question of inter-Korean relations, inter-Korean reconciliation, what do you think President Lee Myung-bak's policies, what do you think the future of reconciliation is? Do you think that DJ's vision of, what was it, one nation, two systems, that sort of vision of Korean Union could ever come to pass?
Well, I don't think the one nation, two systems is going to come to pass. That I really think is a complete non-starter. You know, North Korea is not going to let South Korea run its defense establishment or have anything to do with its defense establishment, nor is North Korea going to let South Korea have anything to do with its foreign policy. For that matter, South Korea is not going to, vice versa, certainly applies. Nor is anybody from South Korea going to be, you know, running around North Korea making political speeches or vice versa. One nation, two systems, I don't think that's going to work. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that there's going to be a second Korean War. There could be, over the years, there could be increasing moderation. There could be increasing projects like the Kaesong Special Zone, which isn't making much money for anybody, but could expand. There could be increasing tourism. Now, I should point out that all tourism to Mount Kumgang was canceled after, when was it, in 2008, a middle-aged Korean housewife looking at the sunset was shot dead by a North Korean soldier. There hasn't been any tourism to Mount Kumgang since then, but it could revive. It could get bigger. A lot of these problems are overcome after episodes like that. Those tremendous, you know, huge headlines, huge confrontation. Everything seems to be lost. And then they get overcome, and life moves on. We would hope that somehow these programs would increase in scope and size, and that there would be increasing, pragmatism in North Korea about reconciliation with the South. North Korea is in a very uncertain stage now. We don't know about Kim Jong-il's health. He certainly appears to be promoting his youngest son to replace him. They've recently revalued their currency, not very successfully, angering a small but significant and rising, small though, but nevertheless an interesting middle class, which was making money somehow. And, of course, they suffer the usual problems of, near starvation and disease and so forth. One would hope that while all this is going on, North Korea would be more of a mood for reconciliation. They might return to six-party talks. They've certainly indicated that. That doesn't mean, however, that they're about to give up their nuclear program. It just means that they're going to try to get a whole lot more money and try to get an end to the sanctions that were imposed by the UN in June after the May 25th nuclear test. Also, they want relations with the United States. They want diplomatic relations with the United States. They would love to bypass South Korea, make South Korea the insignificant younger brother or small brother or whatever, while they had the relationship with the United States and they were the ones that resolved military problems with the U.S. You know, I think all this talk, all this back and forth might go on for years, and certainly that's preferable to a Second Korean War. But I don't see one nation, two systems, which was a dream of Kim Dae-jung, and which, frankly, I'm quite critical of. I don't think it got anywhere. Incidentally, I don't think that he really, and I could be wrong, that was a dream of his during his radical days and during his days as a political opponent of the regime. I don't think he really talked a lot about that when he was president. He kind of dropped that one, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. He wrote one long book about it that was translated into English, and then, but I don't think he ever explicitly
right.
cited. He had this three-phase plan or something.
Right,
he never
right.
explicitly cited it when he was president.
Yeah, to be very honest, you know, frankly, that all that was kind of nonsense. But nonetheless, that had tremendous appeal among American liberal academics, and it had tremendous sort of international appeal at conferences and so forth. None of it bore any relationship to anything going on in Korea. many people will disagree. There might be some people here who might disagree, including Don.
Don, would you like to add anything?
I just have a different kind of question. I sat in his father's, I'm sure you did, many times.
Yeah. You know, I don't know whether he really grew into a different kind of figure, but I can say that when we were there in the 70s, there was an awful lot of excitement attached to him. Like, we were talking to he was often compared when he became president to Nelson Mandela, Lech Walesa, and all that, you know. I wrote a piece for the Asian Wall Street Journal editorial page, which I made made the usual comparisons, you know, right after his election. We had a whole sense of excitement when we went for those conversations. You know, this was like the human rights story, and this was the great dissident figure, and all that. And then we would interview a few Christian people and a few labor people, and get all those subsidiary quotes, which rounded out the story. We didn't get too many quotes, I don't think, from those who really thought he was kind of not all that. You know, I don't think we went around getting those quotes. Now, when he became president, I think he had moderated and modulated his position a lot. And he was no longer that kind of a radical figure. He didn't do away with the national security law, which is interesting. He modified it, didn't go around arresting dozens of people. It certainly did away with torture in its worst forms. No more tear gas on the streets of Seoul was one of his things. So he had changed. But on the other hand, he clung tenaciously to this view of reconciliation with the North. To this policy that seemed to have all these implications which weren't very pleasant, supporting North Korea's nuclear program through payoffs and so forth. Of course, he didn't think he was doing that, and he wouldn't even never admit to doing that. Another point about Kim Dae-jung, which I don't think I mentioned, he never did. I can't remember. He never mentioned North Korea's human rights abuses. He never talked about that in his speeches. He never made any statements about it. South Korea, while he was president, most of the time while No Moo-hyun was president, abstained from UN resolutions on North Korea's human rights program. That changed slightly. I think they went along with one General Assembly resolution when Ban Ki-moon was campaigning to become UN Secretary General. They thought they better, you know, put South Korea's imprimatur on that, you know, just to promote Ban Ki-moon's you know, campaign for the UN Secretary General. But, you know, how much he evolved, I'm not sure. I just know, though, there was a different sense of excitement when we were covering him in the 70s. I think that Kim Dae-jung's courage is something that's very difficult to understand and define, but certainly he did have courage all the way. He was a man of courage. Now, how he became a man of courage, his early origins from this island off Mokpo in the depth of the South Chola region, you know, his going to school in Mokpo and then never going to college, of course, but getting involved in semi-radical movements, moving toward sort of opportunistically almost communist, but not quite communist, you know. He was very clever, by the way, and getting close, but not going over the top, you know, not going over the edge. He never became a communist, as some people, as his conservative critics like to say. He never quite went that distance. But he certainly dabbled, he certainly played with those people. You know, it's very interesting, the drive. What drove this man? How did this man rise from this, from these obscure origins? That's very hard to define. And, you know, somebody will do it. Somebody will write a really great book, which will try to get further into that, into the depth of his character. But for me, it's very hard to define the, what drove him and not a lot of other people. How did he become the master of the Chola region? How did he get 95% of the votes? You know, how did he do that? How did he organize his following? What kind of discipline did he impose, giving all these great open-minded interviews to us Western journalists, but imposing iron discipline among in his own ranks, you know? Tremendous contrast. Many, many questions arise about him. None of which I have the answer to, a lot of which I don't really have much of an adequate response. Right. You know, I'm not completely sure of his relationship with Clinton. He certainly admired Clinton, by the way, and he used to say, in fact, he said that he thought that President Clinton should get a Nobel Prize. He said that, he said that more than once, I guess. But the really interesting, 1994 was the Geneva Framework Agreement when Kim Il-sung was president. And Kim Dae-jung was elected in 1997, and then Madeleine Albright went to Pyongyang in 2000. And that was the time when she met Kim Jong-il and thought he was very smart, and he invited her to a little performance, which turned out to be 100,000 people in May 1st Stadium, you know, showing these cards and flashing these cards and doing all these scenes of the launch of the Taebaedong missile and that kind of thing. There was a sense that many people believe that had it not been for the Florida recount in January of 2001, I guess, President Clinton would have gone to Pyongyang and reached a real understanding with Kim Jong-il. I doubt that. You know, a lot of people here will know a lot more about the inner workings of the White House than I do, but I think President Clinton would have been too smart to do that. I think he would have wanted a real guarantee from North Korea about what they were going to do. I don't think he would have fallen for that. We won't know. And there will be some people here who will say, oh, yes, he was on the verge of going to Pyongyang. I think he would like to give the impression he might have been on the verge of going to Pyongyang. I don't think he would have done it in the final crunch. I do think that Madeleine Albright was very much taken in by Kim Jong-il. I think she doesn't have experience in Northeast Asia, certainly doesn't have experience in Korea, and was very much charmed and taken in by basically his blather. They say that a whole lot of Americans who go to Pyongyang come back sort of converted, as it were. I've heard some people say it must be the water or something like that. But, you know, it's very easy to get taken in Pyongyang. I've been to Pyongyang a few times myself, and believe me, they do a pretty good job. They do a pretty good job, even for someone like me, a journalist on a tourist trip. They talk pretty convincingly, and you have a pretty good time. You eat at good restaurants. People maybe starve me out in the countryside. You don't see them. you're having a good time at restaurants, watching a floor show maybe, chatting with your guide late at night in some hotel. So I think Madeleine Albright was very much taken in by this act. But I don't think, and maybe Don, maybe others will very much disagree with me on this, I don't think, had there been no Florida recount, had Gore been about to become president or whatever, I don't think that President Clinton would have gone to Pyongyang. I don't think he was that dumb. Don, you might disagree. I thought so. Yeah, right. Okay. Well, I appreciate your view. You know, hey, you could be right.
We made it as far as Vietnam, right?
That's right. Yeah, Vietnam, yeah. So. Got a question in the back. I think that to say that a North Korean organization helped to fund his career is a little too direct a connection. But Chosun Sorin, you know, there were links between Hamandong and Chosun Sorin. And by the way, there was a split there. And as a matter of fact, it's interesting to note that in one meeting, as I recall, Kim Dae-jung actually rejected those who wanted to get, you know, make some statements that would really be pro-North statements and so forth. He actually didn't subscribe to that. He avoided. He had a very astute way of not quite going over the edge on stuff like that. Hamandong would have gotten funds from Chosun Sorin. It's interesting that you should criticize Monthly Chosun, which did a bunch of interesting articles. There's a conservative editor of Monthly Chosun, former editor named Chokop Jay, but he's got an awful lot of very, very interesting information. I realize he's very critical of Kim Dae-jung and he's very conservative and all that. He's also got a terrific amount of interesting information. So, you know, but without, you know, going into the reliability of Monthly Chosun, which I have quite a lot of respect, actually. But without going into that, you know, Chosun Sorin, there were ties between people in Hamandong and people in Chosun Sorin. But interestingly, and I don't think they were financing DJ's political campaign directly. And interestingly, DJ rejected some of those people at just some critical moments. Oh, interesting, yeah. Well, thank you for pointing that out. Yeah.
You wrote that with Mitchell Reese.
Yeah. Oh, I think I saw that, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Hi. The furthest extreme, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know if you look at the convention at all, so to me, one of the insidious legacies of such a house is that don't go away with, you know, even in the Northern based on is sort of the legacy of what you didn't do officially. But, I mean, for example, I mean, in the 8th or 10 years between administrations, there's something like under 2 or 3 official, you know, North Korean spies that were ever investigated or caught or whatever it was by the government. But that number has not actually improved greatly since, you know, I mean, the numbers have gone up, but certainly. And so the point is that they're sort of really buried within the system. It's kind of this embedded, you know, unofficial host policies that the two administrations, essentially for 10 years, have established. So, do you agree
with that? Well, sort of, yeah. I mean, you know, of course, obviously, we know that after the June 2000 summit, you know, a bunch of people went back to North Korea, 63 people, one or two of whom, you know, were really serious, you know, serious criminals. I mean, a bunch of them might have been regarded as serious criminals, but one of them had been convicted of helping to kidnap somebody off a beach in Japan. You know, and the Japanese wanted to investigate him, and they were denied any chance to talk to him before he went back to so-called freedom in North Korea. So obviously he didn't, you know, negotiate there, and he didn't go after people. In fact, there were a whole lot of episodes where during the DJ and Nomuyon administration where people, you know, the controversial episodes where people were more or less exonerated. Remember this German sociology professor who came back there? His name I forget. You know, people were more or less let off from any persecution or prosecution, however you want to call it. So you're right. The national security law is there for use when needed, when convenient. But, you know, it might suit their convenience, therefore they never rescinded it. There were tremendous demonstrations, by the way, calling for its recall or revision or whatever. But you're right. It's a good point. They didn't really go after people as they had under previous, and nor is President Im Yong-bak. But I don't think he wants to be in the position of appearing like a reversion to the dictatorial era that preceded. He doesn't want to go back. He doesn't want people to say, "Oh, look, here's a reincarnation of Lee Seung-man or Park Chung-hee." Yeah. Right. Right. But, you know, the trouble with the national security law, though, is people always accuse that of being a tool simply to suppress any kind of opposition, not just North Korea-influenced opposition or pro-communist opposition, but any opposition. You know, these people didn't want anybody really challenging them for the presidency. You know, that's what the Yushin Constitution was all about, I think. So you might disagree. But... So, you know, the national security law could be used not for the purpose for which it was enacted. So you're right. There, you know, some people might say, well, that's a good thing. You know what I mean? We could go on and on with that. Some people might say it's a good thing that they haven't reverted to that previous period and used it and manipulated and used it in that way. By the way, speaking of which, they've arrested quite a few people for the anti-beef demonstrations. They went after them pretty strong. I don't know if it was under the national security law. It could have been. Was it? I'm not sure. I know, for mass destruction. Yeah, right. But they did get a bunch of people for that. Anyway, I think, question from the back. Yes, Scott, how you doing? About what North Korea was doing in terms of nukes? You think they knew stuff about uranium enrichment? Okay. All right. What do I think? My answer is very quick, easy. I don't know. I really don't know. Well, I think they wanted the money, for one thing. They got big payoff, remember. I think that had a lot to do with it. Hey, I mean, $500 million, maybe more, you know. By the way, they just come off this period. They were still in the midst of it, really, of mass starvation. In the mid-late 90s, 2 million people died in North Korea. Famine, starvation, disease, persecution. They were kind of desperate. They still are kind of desperate, actually. But, you know, I think that had something to do with it. They really needed some help. And, you know, I think that had a lot to do with it. But why did he go for Kim Dae-jung? Because Kim Dae-jung had been talking this two systems, one nation line. He'd been talking that for a long time. Incidentally, I wanted to mention that on any tourist trip to North Korea, your guide, your minder, will promote the two systems, one nation line. They talked to me about that the last time I was there, which was in September of 2008. And two of the guys talked about it. One of the guys, a young woman, was talking about it standing up on a microphone on the bus going to Panmunjom. We believe in two systems, one nation. You know, and accusing Im Yong-bak of going back on this idea. So, you know, I think that they liked that idea. Don't forget, Kim Il-sung promoted that idea before his passing. One of the great debates, one of the great arguments that Kim Dae-jung always made was that he didn't get it from Kim Il-sung. He said it first, you know, because he was accused of imitating Kim Il-sung. But Kim Dae-jung always said, no, I got the idea first. I said it first independently. Interesting question of timing there. Sure, they liked that. They liked that, and they still like it. You were recently in Pyongyang. I don't know if they told you about that. I don't know if they only throw that at, you know, naive, know-nothing tourists. I don't know if they tell people like you who've been there a number of times, more sophisticated. Well, in the first place, ways, I don't think I covered that adequately at all. And I think it's a very interesting point, what DJ did in order to improve relations with Japan. He also opened up, Korea to Japanese music and books and things like that. A lot of music was being bootlegged all over Seoul anyway. It was very trendy, some of this Japanese rock and whatever, rap or, Japanese style. J-pop, the equivalent of K-pop, Kim Dae-jung opened up a lot of that. And he was very helpful about that. And I don't cover that adequately, I have to say. So that's an answer to that. Now, a longer book, a different book, might should probably include a chapter on his diplomacy, maybe more than a chapter on his diplomacy with Japan and with China. But particularly to me, of course, the diplomacy with China has so much to do with promoting six-party talks and so forth, with China hosting the six-party talks, everybody looking to China as the great sort of savior, which it may or may not be. China has its own opportunistic ends to pursue and influencing both Koreas and all that. The diplomacy with Japan is interesting and I think bears a lot further study, as you pointed out, more than I do here, a lot more than I do here. One issue, of course, in Korea is the legacy of Koreans who, worked for the Japanese or were influenced by the Japanese or were servants of the Japanese during the Japanese era. There's been tremendous investigations about that. But Kim Dae-jung tried to moderate that and tried to open up Korea to Japanese, literature and music and so forth. Thank you for pointing that out. Bruce. Thank you. Thank you.
I really enjoy hearing you talk about your book. As you know, I really enjoy this book. And I particularly like the realization of the victim and applying it to modern science right now. Because I think that's very important. You and I agree on this better than you probably find yourself. But anyway, I really enjoy that. But getting back to your book, as I read through it, it was surprised after surprise.
Well, this book actually, I should have gotten this book done years ago. And so, it's really my reporting. A lot of it's just my reporting. So, I did a book about the IMF crisis like 10 years ago. And they asked me to do this, biography of Kim Dae-jung then. And I kept on getting caught up in doing stories and stories and stories. And it wasn't until they asked me, where was this book? And, shall we cancel your contract or what, that I actually got around, that I actually did it, So there's so many surprises over the years, but in reporting from Korea, that it's hard to sort of say what was the biggest surprise, but I can say that I think that, the payoff to North Korea might be in that category. The manipulation for the Nobel might be in that category. Some of the instances of corruption certainly came as a surprise. You never cease to be amazed by the sort of interrelationships that go on in Korea. You don't know a lot about them. You think you know, but you don't really know, who influences whom and how the influence is passed and what relationships go on and so forth. There's many surprises like that in Korea. I would say that in that sense, that kind of surprise kept on coming up. Korea's had a very dramatic history. I don't think Americans, we all, the forgotten war and so forth, it's an incredibly dramatic history in the last century, not even half century, but century. Very exciting and dramatic history. One of the more dramatic aspects of that history was the rise of Kim Dae-jung. And, we have a lot of dramas ahead, a lot of surprises ahead. Sometimes we have good news. Who would have suspected that Korea would rise as an economic power? Who would have suspected that Korea could have gone so far toward democracy as it has gone? I'm not saying it's a perfect democracy, but what country is? Who would have suspected all that? Maybe we'll have another pleasant surprise. Maybe there'll be North-South rapprochement. Maybe we'll have people going across the border without passports or without papers. You know, maybe we'll have phone calls. We don't have any of that now. We have no phone calls. We have no email across the border. There's no mail. No, you can't write a letter to someone in North Korea. Maybe all that will dissipate over the next 10, 20, 50 years. Who knows? We could be in for some good surprises. I would not dare to predict the future. I don't know if that answers your question or not. Well, one of the first things he did as president was to try to clean up what the National Intelligence Service, which had been the KCIA. And there was a tremendous scandal involved there, which I go into in the book. I can't quite even remember the details myself. But there was a huge scandal, and there was a huge cleanup of the NIS. But the other interesting aspect of it was that Im Dong-hwan became head of the NIS. And his main role was to form relations with North Korea, architect of the Sunshine Policy, you know, the man who put the Sunshine Policy into place. And he was the head of the NIS. Some people regarded this in itself as a conflict of interest. How could a man who was responsible for the Sunshine Policy be head of the National Intelligence Service? But on the other hand, he certainly toned down the NIS. So the KCIA, there were no more KCIA torture going on, not as far as I know. If somebody else can tell me there was something going on, I'd be interested in hearing, but they stopped all that. So I think that's the most visible, or not visible, but the most obvious aspect. Now, obviously there were conflicts with the military, there were conflicts with the Ministry of National Defense and with those intelligence people. One major point of conflict was the incident when was it? In June of 2002, during the World Cup, when North Korean ships attacked a South Korean, North Korean patrol boat, attacked a South Korean patrol boat, six South Korean sailors were killed. It was said by DJ's critics that the South Koreans were under orders not to fire on the North Koreans until they were fired on, even though the North Koreans were intruding into South Korean water, or not to provoke an incident. So the result was that, you know, you had this incident in which these sailors were killed. Now, DJ didn't say, "Oh, I'm sorry." You know, it was obtuse. He didn't make any remark like, "I'm sorry, both sides are to blame," or anything like that. But defense people certainly thought that he was too soft in dealing with North Korea there. Incidentally, if you go to the naval base in Pyeongtaek, I think it's in Pyeongtaek, you will find the boat that was sunk. The South Korean boat was sunk. It sunk under tow. It got under tow, and then it sank. You will find that boat displayed with all the bullet holes made by the North Koreans. So it's memorialized, and the deaths of these sailors is memorialized. But I'm getting off the subject of intelligence, but I'm simply saying that obviously there was severe resentment, and there were severe disputes, but there was an effort to clean up NIS. Then there was the question of whether Im Dong-hwan should have been head of NIS.
John, congratulations on publishing your book. I was wondering, since it's been out a little while now, what the reaction has been like in South Korea. What reviews have you seen so far, and have they fallen along the predictable lines? And you mentioned, I think briefly, that among Korea's former presidents, many if not most Koreans are ranked in second or first, depending on where you're from, perhaps. But certainly, it may not be saying much, but one of the best Koreans that I've heard. So I was wondering to what extent you were writing this and coming up with your provocative title, whether you would confront a less than warm reaction to the book that you have on the soul.
Well, that's interesting, because so far, you know, the book just came out. So I haven't gotten any reaction from Seoul. I've given one talk at Royal Asiatic Society when I was in Seoul. But I haven't gotten any reaction from Seoul at all. So I'm looking forward to seeing whether there is any when I get back. You know, I don't know if there's going to be any reaction at all. Maybe nobody will notice it. Maybe. And it, by the way, it's rather high price. I'm sorry to say, it wasn't my idea, but this publisher is sort of an academic press. They want libraries and institutions to order copies, and so they price it incredibly high. So it's not like it's within reach of most people. I'm hoping it comes out in paperback and at some reasonable price.
Is it coming out in Korean?
There is a Korean translation supposed to be coming out, but I mean, that'll take 6 months, I guess, or, you know, it takes a long time to translate things, much less to publish them. So,
I imagine this would get some, it would get a very vigorous reaction in Korea. I mean, the interesting thing is, I think it'd get a very vigorous reaction in Korea. Here in the United States, I mean, the thing to me that's interesting is, as Peter said, it's a very, provocative title, Korea Betrayed and DJ and Sunshine. But, the thing about the American view of Kim Dae-jung is that it's really not about sunshine policy. I mean, many of us, contemporary analysts, we think of him as sunshine policy. But the way most Americans look at Kim Dae-jung, to the extent they look at him at all, they associate him with democracy. And they associate him with the 87 democratic transition and the long fight for freedom and all that. And arguably, that's one of the reasons why he won the Nobel Peace Prize, right, after he became president. So I think in the minds of many Americans, it's difficult for them to think ill of Kim Dae-jung because Kim Dae-jung represents what was successful about the American Cold War experiment in Asia, right? That basically Korea succeeded as a market democracy, a war-torn, poverty-stricken country that succeeded as a market democracy. And then Kim Dae-jung is associated with that, I think, in the minds of any Americans who even care to think about the issue of the problem. So, I mean, I personally don't think that's a full treatment or understanding of Kim Dae-jung at all. But I think, for many Americans, going back to, as you said, the Reagan administration and what they did to try to save him and his years in prison and the association with him and Mandela and Malesa and Michael Jackson puts him in his videos and, all this sort of stuff, this is the impression that many Americans have of Kim Dae-jung, which is very different from the impression in South Korea. Or to that extent, as Scott said, in North Korea, I mean, I think one of the reasons Kim Jong-un wanted to meet Kim Dae-jung was because it was Kim Dae-jung. Kim Dae-jung was this lion figure, not just in the minds of, sort of the American liberals, but also in the minds of some North Koreans. And in that sense, you're right. I mean, it's astounding how this guy from Mokpo, right, became a lionized figure both in the eyes of North Koreans, American elite, right, and a whole generation of 386, younger generation of Koreans. And then to find out, as you did, all the things that were wrong with sunshine policy. It really is interesting.
Well, you presented, a really very good balancing. I can't argue with anything you've said, actually. You balanced the picture there. And I would admit that perhaps my book is not as balanced as it should be. I'll admit that. And the title is about... No, but you see, I had a book called Korean Crisis and Korean Dynasty. So this was Korea Betrayed, BCD. And you've got to consider that factor in the title, too, I was. Right, I don't think Lee Myung-bak's rhetoric got all that strong. Well, what Lee Myung-bak did, which really hurt, was to cut off any aid. They were no longer getting that. What was it, 500,000 tons? Yeah, they were no longer getting that aid. That's a body blow,
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Yeah, I don't know that North Korea fell betrayed, but they certainly. By the way, they took a long time before they started criticizing Kim Jong Bak. They didn't criticize him during the campaign. They didn't criticize him during his inauguration. Then, I think about a couple of months later, they started really laying into him. I think that was when he cut off the when he said there would be no more aid unless they gave up their nukes or something or other. Then they started calling him a traitor and a lackey and everything. They waited until they really sort of figured out where he was going. But I don't think he's all that hard necessarily. All that hard line, incidentally, you know. So there you are. But, you know, your remarks provide a balancing, leavening, I would say, which is very helpful. And I can't argue with that view at all, you know.
Well, thank you. I look forward to reading the book. And thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for moderating all your time.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Thank you.